Welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Bren Smith. He actually will be a returning guest. He was on my guest on my show before, but I invited him back on to talk about his new book, Eat Like a Fish. And so he will be on in a little bit talking to us about his 3D ocean farming and the work he's doing as a regenerative fisherman. And before he comes on, though, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, ways that you can take action, and of course, this week's recipe. So when it comes to taking action, there's so many different things, and they are listed on my website, but the big one is happening tomorrow. Tomorrow is the huge global strike. And this is a global strike for climate change, to raise awareness, to set out a clear path of what our demands are and what we want to see going forward. And I, fortunately, am in New York, where there will be a huge, huge rally starting at noon in Foley Square. And I hope to be there. I will be getting there late because I have my school day to finish out before I can leave. But it is, I'm actually hoping the school is partially empty and that most of the students in the school are heading into the city, because this is a youth-led movement. This is their future. And it is so wonderful. And the adults have been invited to make this event an intergenerational event. And the demands that the global movement is looking for are really very clear, straightforward. A Green New Deal. We want to transform the economy to 100% clean, renewable energy by 2030 and phase out all fossil fuel. We want to halt the leasing and permitting of fossil fuel extraction. And that includes, you know, New York, it's great. We don't frack, but we're still part of the infrastructure. We're still building those pipelines. The Williams Pipeline is, you know, another take action item on my list. That's set to go right through New York Harbor, and it's looking like it might pass. I mean, it's insanity. So we have to stop this. We have to respect the indigenous land. I mean, we, you know, when we took over this country and displaced the indigenous people, we, you know, gave them land that we thought was invaluable. Well, fast forward a couple hundred years, and we realize that the land they're on's not so unprofitable, and we're trying to use our power and use eminent domain, and, you know, not necessarily displace them totally, but go in and destruct their land and go through ancestral grounds and build pipelines. And that just has to stop. We have to honor the treaties that protect the indigenous land, water, and the sovereignty by the immediate halt of all construction, leasing, and permitting for resource extraction on their lands. And we need to recognize the rights of nature into law and protect our sacred ecosystems and align human law with the natural law and ban resource extraction in defense of our environment and people. Environmental justice is another big one that they're calling for. We need to invest in prosperity in communities that are on the front lines. I mean, climate crisis mostly will impact those that are in poverty, and, you know, when they're building incinerators and recycling plants, and they always go into the poorer neighborhoods that are not as well mobilized to fight against it. So we need to all band together and not let that happening. And we need to also really work on the inequality, the violence, and lack of opportunity for those that are in need in this country, and just, you know, level the playing field a little bit more. We have to protect and restore biodiversity. Right now, you know, our biodiversity is down like 90%. I mean, it's just really horrendous. And so we need to protect and restore 50% of the world's lands and oceans, including a halt to all deforestation by 2030. And lastly, they're looking for the implementation of sustainable agriculture. And as I've talked about many times, regenerative agriculture can actually help mitigate some of the problems of climate change by sequestering some of the carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. And we need to invest in farmers and in regenerative agriculture that is doing that. And end all the subsidies for the industrial agriculture, which doesn't do that, which just feeds the corporate wealth cycle that we really need to put an end to. So they have really, really great, clear demands, and we all need to get behind that. And it's just so urgent. I mean, you know, I talk to young people all the time, and so many are choosing to not have children because they don't want to bring their children into this world. And if the people that care about this world are deciding not to have children because they're too afraid of the future, well, who's going to be left having children? Those that are not paying attention or that are too busy to pay attention that the world is falling apart, then they're going to have children that are, you know, aren't going to be equipped to help deal with the problem. So we really need to come together around this climate crisis. And that has to start also politically in this country, because we have a person in the White House that is just unbelievable. I mean, every day, there is a new thing. Yesterday, it was, you know, rolling back the environmental protections with the car exhaust. And, you know, California has their own laws that they set up that the car manufacturers have agreed to, and they're all set to go forward with that. And now Trump is trying to roll that back and say that California has no right to make their own laws. Set to go to the Supreme Court, probably, eventually, but look who's in the Supreme Court. Thank you, Mr. White House. So we just have to, you know, work together. The Democrats have to work together so that we don't split the vote between two of the front runners and end up with a moderate Democratic person that does not see all these Green New Deal rights that we are trying to fight for as priority. So we have a lot of work to do. And one of the ways to do it without getting overly depressed is by banding together with others that are really looking towards the future. And the energy that you get when you go to a rally or a march like this is enormous. It helps feed you and gives you the energy to carry on, because otherwise you just want to lock yourself in a room and cry. I know that's how I feel so much of the time. And so we need to band together. So another take action I have on my newsletter this week was General Electric, who, you know, says they, you know, support the Paris Climate Agreement and they care about the future of energy. But meanwhile, they're funding coal power plants around the world. And that's got to stop. So, you know, there's so many contradictions that are happening on a regular basis. And for those that missed the article in Tuesday's science section of the New York Times, there was a great article that exposed the International Life Sciences Institute, which is a nonprofit, American nonprofit organization that was funded and started over four decades ago by a top Coca-Cola executive. And its members consist of, you know, DuPont, Pepsi, General Mills, Nestle, Danone. I mean, it's just, you know, a list of some of the biggest corporations that care about their stockholders and the bottom line and do not care about the health and future of our planet. And, you know, they might do some little greenwashing here or there, but in general, this organization, the International Life Sciences Institute, is a covert organization that's infiltrating all these health, World Health Organizations, including the World Health Organization. But, you know, they're going into a lot of Latin American and Asian countries and trying to infiltrate the committees that they have set up to protect the people. I mean, obesity and diabetes and, you know, our Western health issues have been exported into these other countries with all the junk food and soda that we are promoting. And, you know, things like in India, they were trying to put a big red label on unhealthy foods, and it was looking like it was going to go forward, and then this organization got involved, and they stopped it dead in their tracks. So the warning labels to help protect the public against eating some of the foods that are being pushed on them are being stopped. And so you should really read that article. I have a link on my website at ieatgreen.com. But it's just really fascinating. I mean, big food, big pharma, big agribusiness, they are all over it. They know what they have to do to keep their profits up, and they don't care about anything else. You know, look what we saw with Purdue. I mean, they just, you know, still continuing on and, you know, taking their money out of the country to other places to try to avoid it. And they'll pay a little penalty, which is, you know, sounds like a big penalty, but to them it's like a little Band-Aid, and then they're going to go on and do it again. So that's what the OxyContin issue I'm talking about. So we really need to band together and, you know, coming out on Friday in New York City, if you're in the New York City area, but you can go to the website Strike With Us and plug in your zip code and find a rally or march near where you live to get involved. But the energy around this is really exciting, and I think it's, you know, a movement that is going to be unstoppable, and we all need to get on it because time is running out. Okay, I want to share with you my recipe this week. It's a really easy recipe. As you know, I am a farm-to-school coordinator now for our local public school. I'm in the Glen Cove School District. And so every month I'm introducing a new vegetable to the students. 3,200 students this week are tasting this recipe of steamed Swiss chard. I got rainbow Swiss chard, and I made a lemon garlic herb sauce. So it's very simple. You can certainly play with it. But one of the things that's so nice is that when you steam greens and then blanch them, you get to lock in the color, which makes a big difference. And I found that out because I developed the recipe at home when I got to the school. They did not have ice water to blanch the greens. So my idea and desire to have bright green greens did not really work out at the school. So it's part of a live and learn situation here. But anyway, this is steamed rainbow chard. You want to wash and cut. Well, I started with 4 bunches of Swiss chard. And this made enough for, you know, 10 side portions if you're serving it with a meal. So you can certainly cut it in half if you're a smaller group than that. But I started with 4 large bunches of Swiss chard and 6 tablespoons of olive oil, 4 cloves of garlic, juice from 1 lemon, a half a cup of parsley and half a cup of basil. Feel free to use more if you have more, and a half a teaspoon of salt. I washed and cut the Swiss chard into bite-sized pieces. And, you know, if you line up the leaves and then kind of roll them, that's a real easy way of cutting the leaves so that you get nice thin strips of leaves. But you can actually then end up with long strips of leaves, almost like the spaghetti, so you might want to take the knife and go down in the other direction just to cut them into more bite-sized pieces, especially if you're serving this to children. Then I steamed the greens until they were wilted and bright green, which was about 4 minutes, and then I blanched them in ice water, and that just cools them down and locks in the flavor so it would stay bright green. And then I squeezed out all the excess water and placed it in a large bowl and set that aside. And then I made a sauce in the mini Cuisinart. When I was doing it at the school, of course, I did it in my Vitamix, which made it much easier. And you just put all of the ingredients, the olive oil, the garlic, the lemon, the parsley, basil, and salt, into the blender or food processor and process it until smooth. And then you can either toss the Swiss chard with the sauce, which looked great when it was bright green, but when it was darker green, like at the school, I found it looked better for me to just take the greens, you know, squeeze the water out, and then put a dollop of the sauce on top, which was bright green color and looked really beautiful. So that's what I ended up doing, and it worked out really great, and The sauce was almost like a pesto-ish type sauce, except there was that lemon flavor and there were no nuts because, of course, the school was nut-free. But it came out really lovely, and many of the kids were willing to taste it and liked it. You know, there were certainly kids coming up for seconds, so that was really, really wonderful. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Bren Smith. He is the executive director of both Green Wave and Thimble Island Ocean Farm. And he's returning to the IE Green Radio Show to talk about his new book, Eat Like a Fish, which is his story of his path from fisherman to restorative ocean farmer. And I'll let him tell us more about his work. Bren, are you with me?
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me, Bren. It's nice to have you back.
Yeah, it's an honor.
Thank you. So let's just backtrack a little bit, and if you could share with my listeners who did not hear you on the show the last time, tell us a little bit about your history as a fisherman, how you got into the sustainable fish market, and then maybe a little bit about your new book.
Yeah, sure. So, and by the way, thanks for that commentary. I think the sort of youth heading out on a climate strike is just, it really is one of our great hopes. I was listening to, I forget who it was, one of the leaders said something. He said, we feel like there's not enough ambition in the world. It was such a great framing of it. Like, they want more, they want bigger, and they really believe they can do this. So it's really amazing to see.
These rallies, that's where you get the ambition and that energy. When you're alone at home reading the paper, like I said, you want to crawl in your room and cry. When you're out in the rally and you get that energy, it's contagious. It's wonderful.
Exactly. You know, physical presence still matters, right? It really does. And it builds solidarity. And, you know, one of the things I think why I feel, since I took my boat to the climate march and the first one to New York City, and then I took my boat to the Washington, D.C. climate march. And one of the things that why I felt so welcome there, and actually more welcome than I often feel like in the ocean space and the seafood place, is that it really was sort of what I think of as a politics of yes. It was people coming together. And this is really, I think, where the movement is. I'm not just saying no, not just stopping stuff like, which we have to do, stopping pipelines and coal plants and, you know, destructive monocultural ag. But actually, what's the yes? What's the solution? Like, as a movement, we can build the economy we want. We can bring solutions to the table and really offer new opportunities for folks that struggle and really deserve to be in the front of the line as we're building a new green economy. So that I just feel so comfortable in that politics of yes and the solutions-based change, which is quite honestly new for the environmental movement. You know, traditionally it's really been a conservation frame. It's been a no stopping all the bad things in the world. And
right.
We've all joined together under this larger tent of like, okay, we're going to build it. We're not going to wait for others to.
Right. It's great.
Yeah.
So let's hear how you're doing it, because you're doing it.
Well, I'm just a little piece of a puzzle, you know, like I'm just a,
well, that's what it takes.
Kid.
It takes all these little pieces.
Exactly. I think, you know, it's going to take 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 solutions all working together, you know. I was born up in Newfoundland, Canada. My parents were actually refuseniks. They were draft dodgers out of New York and headed up to Newfoundland. And I was born and raised there, a little fishing village, you know, on the edge of the earth. It's the most eastern point in all of North America. Fishermen's co-op, you know, little houses painted with leftover boat paint, sort of, you know, bright greens, oranges, things like that.
And, home from come from away.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. That's
a show for anyone who has not seen that Broadway show.
It's stunning. And it was awesome. When I went, my wife surprised me. She brought me on my birthday. And it was filled with Newfoundlanders, and they treated it like a hockey game. Like, the actors came out, and they all started cheering and waving flags, and it was just such a refreshing theater. And some old-time theater goers were behind me, and they're like, clearly these people don't know how to do the theater.
That's great.
Proud moment. Anyway, so, you know, my heroes, you know, they weren't astronauts. They certainly weren't, bankers and lawyers at the time. But they were, and fishermen. And so through my life, it's really been a question of why did I fall in love with becoming a fisherman? It was all around me. But there's something about the identity of, you know, they're heading out on a horizon, disappearing. They own their own boats. They have self-directed lives. They're feeding local communities. They, you know, succeed and fail on their own terms. Like, that's what I wanted for my life. And it's what, you know, I've been driven off the ocean many, many times and been lost. And I become a terrible person the longer I am on land. But but I've always tried to find the water, even here, in, you know, locked in the suburbs of Connecticut, of all places. But so I dropped out of high school when I was 14 and, you know, headed out to sea. And I was in the late 80s, and I fished in Gloucester and Lynn, fished in the Bering Sea. I was in Bristol Bay, so all over the place. I still miss that job. I just loved it. It's just so thrilling to be out in the lawless ocean, and sort of the solidarity of being, you know, with a group of folks for, you know, 3 months at a time out at sea. It's just amazing. The trouble was, you know, I was just like the tar sands, the oil fields. You know, this is that was the most destructive form of food production on the planet at that point. We were fishing illegal waters, tearing up entire ecosystems with trawls, you know, and most of my fish was going to McDonald's. So, you know, terrible fishing practices, creating terrible food. And so clearly that wasn't the future, even though it was for a kid, it was a great place to start.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did you decide that you didn't want to be part of that system and you wanted something new?
Yeah, so I wasn't an environmentalist as we think of them traditionally, but the cod stocks crashed back home in Newfoundland. I think that was 94, 92, right around there. And 30,000 people thrown out of work, largest layoff in Canadian history. And, walking hungry ghosts in the street, people with no direction, plants closed, thousands of boats beached. And that's where I first understood that, unless we protect the ecology, there are going to be no jobs on a dead planet. Like, this isn't for me about birds and bees and bears. It's actually about, you know, kitchen table issues, people making a living, making a dignified living. But that is intricately tied and forever tied to protecting and rebuilding our ecosystem. So that was the beginning. That wasn't sort of, you know, clear set of thoughts at that point. And I headed to what was supposed to be the answer to overfishing, which was aquaculture on the salmon farms in the early 90s, and went there, you know, supposed to be create the new jobs, feed the planet, protect fish stocks. But instead it was equally as destructive as the wild fishery at that time. It polluting local waterways. We're growing terrible tasting food, use of pesticides, antibiotics, all these things we know. So disillusioned, I kept searching, and I followed a woman down to Long Island Sound and found myself in one of the what I thought was one of the most desolate places in America, was the suburbs of Connecticut. And but then slowly remade myself first as an oysterman. And I think that was the real turning point of asking this question: if, you know, 90% of our fish stocks are either overfished or fished unsustainably. Climate change I just came back from Alaska working with some indigenous communities there, and it's just amazing how climate change is right here and now wreaking havoc on their fisheries. The wild fishery can't bear the burden of rising population and the impacts of climate change. So we need to find a new way to get food from the ocean. But we need to ask the ocean what makes sense to grow, right? Like, what's unique about the ocean as an agricultural space? And my oysters taught me that it just makes sense to grow things that don't swim away and you don't have to feed, right? It's right. So simple, right? All the, you know, so if you can grow things that just filter out the, you know, eat the nutrients that are already there. And we actually have too many nutrients in our ocean, too much carbon, too much nitrogen, things like that. And for seaweeds, just soak up sunlight. It becomes a really elegant, powerful way to grow food, and quite honestly, a good small business, because the overhead's so much lower when you don't have to pay money for pens, for nets, for feed, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was listening to NPR yesterday, and they were talking about, you know, the problem with plastics, and they were talking about how, you know, most of the plastic we think that's getting recycled is not really getting recycled. It's either going to landfill or out into the oceans. And how it doesn't break down, or it breaks down over time in the oceans, but just into smaller pieces. And then the fish eat it, and then we're eating the fish. And they said the average American is eating a credit card's worth of plastic every week.
That's insane. God, that's
in
just
small pieces of plastic. Isn't that amazing?
So I never thought I'd become a seaweed farmer. As a fisherman, it's kind of embarrassing. It's kind of boring. You know, I never wanted to drink tea with arugula farmers. Like, that's not my thing, right? I hunt and kill things. But when you stumble on seaweed, it just is this stunning thing where we can actually create plastics. They're not plastics. They're bioplastics out of seaweed. So the London Marathon had seaweed water bottles for its runners this year. Places like Lollyware and others are making clothing and packaging. So other companies are making packaging for food. So imagine this, right? That as a farmer, I could be growing packaging with zero inputs, no fresh water, no fertilizer, no feed, no use of land, nothing, and actually begin drawing down the petroleum-based plastics industry. I mean, and so that's what's so exciting about, I think, this space. Yes, it's about delicious, beautiful food, but it's also about how can we look at the oceans as one of the great answers to climate change? The amazing thing is the Green New Deal mentions the oceans one time, right? More of the U.S. is underwater than above. Our oceans have soaked up 30% of the world's human-based carbon and 90% of the heat generated, and 40% of us live in coastal counties, right? But we just, our back is to the sea. And so if we turn around and actually look out to the ocean, we can rebuild our kelp forests and sequester incredible amounts of carbon, for example. So if you were to rebuild the kelp forests in California grow kelp in 3% of California's water, you could offset the entire agricultural footprint of the state. Like, it's just stunning, right? And that's a new paper that just came out.
Can you say that one more time so that everybody can really get that?
If you were to farm 3% of California waters, but farm meaning reforest, right? Create blue carbon sinks, just like we do redwood reforesting. Let's do reforesting of kelp, but have, you know, fishermen, farmers, everybody out there doing it, sort of the planting. 3% of California waters can offset the entire agricultural footprint of the state of California. Like, it's stunning, right? And so this is we just finished up a thing called the Blue New Deal, and a whole platform, and it's called Blue Jobs and the Green New Deal. And at the climate town hall in New York, I asked a question of Elizabeth Warren, saying, like, hey, what about, you know, oysters are dying up and down the coast, fisheries are threatened, what could be in a Blue New Deal? She immediately sort of took that, she used it, she talked about a Blue New Deal in her closing statements. And so I think this, including the oceans into the basket of climate solutions, I think this is the time to do it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you get this question a lot, but when you're raising oysters and or seaweed and cleaning up the ocean using that method, what happens to the oysters and the kelp? Could that still be eaten, or is that now contaminated?
Yeah, so we do things what we think of as sort of pollution farming, where we plant in urban ports. So we're working in the Port of San Diego, for example, and there are species that will grow that we just don't touch. We leave in the waters to rebuild those forests and the ecosystem. The billion oyster project right in New York City. It's just been a groundbreaking organization in this. And just let's plant a billion oysters in the harbor, not eat them, but let those engines of restoration, the coral reefs of the East Coast, really be the do their job, and we don't have to eat them. And same with kelp. Like, let's grow that kelp and allow it to be a carbon sink. And it can soak up, you know, pollution, but we don't eat it. We just allow it to function as a forest in the ocean.
And does it continue attracting the carbon and sinking it, or does it like kind of get full and then you need to plant more?
Yeah. So the new studies say that there are a couple things. One is when it dies, it sinks into the sediment. And then it's sequestered from up to sort of 1,000 years, which is great. You can also take it and sink it in the deep trenches, so you get even more sequestration there. You know, we would love to just, and we would want to keep planting continually as farmers and having those carbon sinks. The other thing I'd say is we don't have seaweeds and plastics. Anyways, they're not, you know, they don't eat or filter. So they're not internalizing the plastics, which is really good. Just as, you know, we have to deal with the plastics problem, we got to deal with it now. But one of the good things about seaweeds is that it doesn't the plastics don't become part of the plant.
Yeah, one of the things that I have been hearing about and reading about when we're talking about building those pipelines like the Williams Pipeline underneath the Long Island Sound or, you know, New York Harbor, is the fear of what it's going to dig up when you go down into the bottom of the waters. You know, I mean,
exactly.
All this that has been sequestered down there is now getting stirred up.
Exactly. Like, we want that, the Clean Water Act, one of the great piece of legislation in American history, and one of the most effective. You know, what's happened to all those heavy metals that were in New York Harbor is they've sunk down into the mud, and that's where you want to keep them. You want them to stay there. Other, if you disturb it, it goes back into the water column, right? So the water is amazingly clean, and you just want to let that mud be. You know, the other thing, so I did the book, it's, you know, Eat Like a Fish is the title. I discovered all these things that I hadn't known. One is, you know, we think of seaweed as a Eastern, you know, something out of Japan and China, and certainly there's incredible storied history there. There's also this incredible Western history. So, and the East and West have met and shared sort of these moments in the cultivation of seaweed. So the woman who modernized and really scaled the nori industry in Japan was a British woman, Dr. Drew Baker, who invented a way to actually seed the farms. And there's I went to Japan, and there's a statue to her and a holiday once a year that all the farmers celebrate in her honor for building the industry. Then you go to the Port of San Diego. In the early 1900s, there were 1,500 workers in processing 52 different kelp products. A lot of it feed and fertilizer, natural-based organic fertilizer for the Midwest. So this was an incredible industry that was there, and it was a food source. So in Irish and Scottish bars, you'd find seaweed all the time as a bar snack. Italians turned it into fritters and fermented it. In Newfoundland, there's a long, long tradition of it being the, you know, freshest vegetable. Italians used it as a soup base. So there's just everywhere there have been people on the ocean and on the coast. They've been using seaweeds, and remember, there are 10,000 different kinds of seaweeds in the ocean, an incredible amount of variation. But this history's kind of been lost, and in many ways, it's been lost by, as you know, the soy industry and industrial food pushed that variation off the plate. One of the real sort of losses was this, you know, ocean-based sea vegetables.
Well, so let's take just a couple minute break, and when we come back, if you could explain to everyone what 3D ocean farming is. I think, you know, people kind of have an idea in their head, but they don't really know. So let's talk about that, and then the questions will come from there. So everyone listening, right. I'm talking with Bren Smith, Executive Director of Green Wave and author of the new book, Eat Like a Fish. And you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and we'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Welcome back, everyone. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Bren Smith, the Executive Director of Green Wave and author of Eat Like a Fish, about 3D ocean farming, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. So, Bren, can you tell us what is 3D ocean farming?
Sure. So, think of it as polyculture in the sea, and it's really using these great benefits of the ocean. One is, you know, that we can grow food that's zero input, no fresh water, no fertilizer, no feed, not use of any land. And because the ocean is we kind of don't have to fight gravity, we're able to design under there with really simple design. So we think of it as 3D ocean farming. Just imagine an underwater garden, vertical garden, where you have anchors at the edges of the farm and then ropes that go up to the surface to buoys. And then about 8 feet below the surface, you've got horizontal lines, like a rope scaffolding system. And from there, we grow our seaweeds vertically downwards. So our kelp will seed on the lines, and then it grows over several months down, you know, 12, 15 feet. And then we have mussels next to that in mussel socks. They look like sort of long sausages. We have lantern nets with scallops and oysters in them. And then down the bottom, we have cages with oysters, and then down in the mud you have clams. And it's really, you know, how many different species can you grow in a 20-acre area? We only grow native species. So whether it's in Alaska, California, you know, the Faroe Islands, wherever, you look at the ecosystem and you figure out what are the restorative crops that you grow. Again, we just grow things that don't swim away and you don't have to feed, and crops that aren't just sustainable, right? So because sustainability is about low impact. It's sort of like about making bad things better, right? Clothing, for example, you can make it better, but it still has an impact on the planet. Where we need to move, and land-based is really moved in this space, is regenerative things, restorative things. So all of our crops soak up carbon, nitrogen, rebuild reefs, They function as storm surge protectors. Like, these aren't just farms. These are engines breathing life back into our oceans and really helping fight climate change.
Uh-huh. Now, how do you get the eggs or the, you know, the seeds to do this?
Yeah, so we'll take, for something like shellfish, you go take a couple shellfish, you know, 8 or 10, and you bring it back. We've got a hatchery. You get them to spawn into tanks, and then with the seaweed, we could take a couple pieces of seaweed and raise the water temperatures, and they spawn as well, and put out seed for the kelp. What happens is we have a pipe thing, you know, like 50 fish tanks, and with some pipes in each one with string wrapped around each pipe, and the spores stick to that string. And then the string we take out to our farm and unravel it along our ropes. And that's the start, and then that's it. Our only job as farmers is to make sure our seed gets the right amount of light and the right amount of nutrients, just making sure it's sitting in that sweet spot in the water column.
Uh-huh. And the thing that I remember from our last time of talking, which, again, my listeners that are just joining didn't have that privilege of hearing it, is that it doesn't really disrupt the ability for this water to still be used recreationally, right? Boats can still go over it. People can swim over it, right? Because it's below the surface.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a low aesthetic impact. You know, you just see some buoys on the surface. And then, you know, like a massive sailboat couldn't go through, but our farms are inshore. But we can, and I boat over our farm all the time because all the gear is down below the surface. And it's important, right? We want to create community spaces. People come dive through our kelp forest. Some of the best fishing in the whole area is right on the farm because there's so much activity. There are just so many species working in concert. It really is a reef. So we, you know, I think the long-term vision here is, can we create sea trusts, sort of like land trusts, but out in the ocean, sea trusts, where there are mixes of reforestation of shellfish and seaweed. There are farmers farming and harvesting food, fertilizers, feed, things like that. And then there's, you know, small-scale community fishing in these same areas. And we can really sort of organize that land use.
Uh-huh.
For the ocean use.
Probably a land use, but it's water use. And I know for young farmers who actually want to do farming on land, it's incredibly difficult for them to get land, to purchase land, to be able to afford land. How is it for young fishermen who want to get started with a 3D farm? What kind of initial input do they need? How do they get access to coastal water? Who owns the water? I mean, obviously not them. How do you get rights to that?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, so we have a waiting list at Green Wave. Green Wave is a nonprofit. We train so the new generation of ocean farmers, and we've got a waiting list of 4,000 people, and which is just heartbreaking. But a lot of those are young land-based farmers who can't afford land, right? And out in the ocean, my lease is $50 an acre per year, right? Incredibly cheap, and I don't own it. I have a lease from the town. So the way leases work is, you know, rent, like in Connecticut, for example, the first couple miles are town owned, then out from there the state owns, and then further out to shore it's federal lands. So you go to whatever agency makes sense. I generally lease all mine from at the town level, and then I don't own that property. What I own is the right to grow shellfish and seaweed. Anybody can do anything else on the farm. They can commercially fish. They can do whatever they want. I just own the right to grow seaweed and shellfish. That's the only thing people can't do on that property. So it's like a process right, not a property right. And then my lease is up for review every few years, which is really good because if I'm doing terrible stuff there, you want to lever a community control for those of us that are building our farms. So I really like the ownership model. It maintains the commons. It's not like oil rigs and big salmon pens and things like that. It really is an alternative path.
Uh-huh. And so with Green Wave, you train young people how to do this, how to build a 3D farm?
Yeah, like everything from young people to old people. I've got 11th generation fishermen in Rhode Island that we're working with indigenous communities like the Eyak tribe, Dune Lankard, who actually Dune led the battle against Exxon. I don't know if you remember the big spill, the Valdez spill. He led the fight and represented all the native communities against Exxon and for that big court settlement. But he is he came to me 2 years ago and said the salmon are not returning, and it's just brutally had the worst salmon season in 100 years. So we're helping him, you know, and his community set up farms. We have incredibly about a year and a half ago, GreenWave stepped back and looked at who was in the industry, who's in the hatcheries, who are the entrepreneurs creating new, you know, products, and who are the farmers. It's a majority women, which is crazy, right? I started GreenWave, I thought it was going to be old grumpy fishermen like me, but it's majority women, and it's people like Catherine Puckett out in Block Island. So she grows oysters, clams, and kelp. She has a pink boat and an all-male crew. And those guys love the job because they don't have to leave island in the winter, right? Which a lot of people have to do in in Block Island and Martha's Vineyard and stuff. So they it's a year-round job, but they hate working on a pink boat. They find it incredibly embarrassing. But maybe that's the future of this blue economy. Like maybe women don't, it's not about equity. It's actually they become the architects and builders of this new blue economy. And I'm so curious to see what's going to be different, like how women will structure it in new ways. I think that's a really exciting piece of this. And I mean, that points to this, you know, we have, what's fun about this space, I think, is because the oceans are a blank slate, we get to take all the lessons from land-based agriculture, the existing economy, what it looks like, and then all the lessons from aquaculture, and build something new out to sea from the bottom up. I mean, can we weave social justice into the DNA of this new economy, make sure that indigenous communities, women, low-income folks, they get the opportunities to go out to sea and start building farms? Can we make sure that our seed isn't privatized, right? That it's actually publicly protected, unlike land-based ag. How do we make sure we protect the commons? Like all those things we get to just build from the bottom up. We kind of get to do food and ag the right way this time. And I think that's that's the exciting prospect. Well, there's so much dire news in the era of climate change. We're actually having kind of a fun time trying to solve all these new problems and build something from scratch. And I'd say it's not like me. There's people all over the world working on this at this point. There's a real movement. It's like a tsunami of interest. And you go to pretty much every coastal state in the world now, and people are trying to figure out how to do new restorative, regenerative ocean farming. And I think that's really exciting because we're going to get 1,000 blue collar solutions coming and happening on the ocean. That's really what we need. We need an army of people that are, climate warriors out there, building solutions and creating opportunity and drawing down the world's carbon footprint.
Absolutely. Now you said you have a waiting list of 4,000 fishermen already. What realistically, how likely is it that you're going to get down to the 4,000th person? And when you are taking applications from potential farmers, are you looking at their background at all, or where they're coming from, or what impact they might be having when they learn these new techniques, is whether they're bringing it back to indigenous community or a more impoverished community? Does that go into any of the decision-making process when you're picking who you're training next?
Yeah, I mean, so of the 4,000 people, some are fishermen, some are farmers, some are, lawyers, some are like, it's a whole range of people that are interested. The challenge with us is the teaching program is really high touch. We help people permit. We help them set up farms. They get free seed for a couple years. We help connect them to markets. You know, we've got a farmer hotline, so when they have questions, things like that. So it's really high touch, which is needed. But to meet the larger demand, we're working on an online toolkit and platform, right? And that'll be rolling out probably in the next 12 months, where people with all sorts of skills, sort of more capacity, can come and start this on their own, right? And a platform where people can then be sharing knowledge and learning from each other. And I think that's how, so we don't have to do the hands-on training of everybody. Everybody we train has to sign a document where they agree, one, to, you know, principles of sustainability, but also agree to share their knowledge and help other folks get started. That's part of the sort of train-the-trainer model that we've adopted. Now, our low touch is really the sort of, you know, the online platform, allowing anybody open source at all, and that allows for scale. The high touch really is what we're developing is a really social justice sort of, you know, a framework where it's fishermen directly affected by climate change, women and indigenous communities are the folks that we're really moving towards. In our first couple of years of training, we just trained people who we thought would have the highest chance of success building farms. So that would be shellfishermen that are diversifying their farms and adding, going from, you know, single species to multi-species, former fishermen that had boats, things like that. But now we've moved our programming really to, now that we know how to train people and we feel really comfortable with our programming, we've got a whole team of 13 people now. It's really shifting, and Alaska is where we're doing our first work. That said, this isn't just about the ocean. Like, our vision of this is what we think of as green wave reefs, where you have 25 small-scale farms, a processing hub, and a hatchery in a community, in a struggling low-income community, and then rings of entrepreneurs, people creating value-added products, and then you replicate that green wave reef up and down the coast, right? And that allows us to go to scale. That land-based infrastructure, I think, is incredible opportunity. So to lift up communities and make sure communities benefit from this new economy. And so an example would be, we're working with the Hope Alliance in the Bronx right now, should be Sustainable South Bronx, it's in the early planning stages, but to build a fertilizer plant. So one thing I didn't say about seaweeds is, yeah, it's food. We can make it delicious, beautiful food. Our chefs are doing that. It's just amazing, but it's not just that. We can make it what I think of as the soy of the sea, but not evil. We know soy industry is, you know, destructive, monoculture, pesticide, things like that. We don't have that problem, but we can grow our seaweeds. No, what I was going to say is what the soy industry did in the 1950s is they sat down and are like, we're never going to get Americans to eat soy, so let's put it in everything. And that's what they did. They turned it into an ingredient. And now you see soy in literally not only food, but also like table. Like, it's just made out of, it's in all of products. So kelp and other seaweeds is incredible fertilizer. It's an incredible feed that farm animals have been eating for forever. It's a bioplastic. It can be used as a biofuel, all these sort of things. So the fertilizer project in the South Bronx is building a worker-owned fertilizer plant, and the hope is to supply take all the waste from New England, all the sort of non-food grade seaweeds and shellfish that are coming off the farms, and move it to the fertilizer plant to provide fertilizer for New York City parks. And that's an example with how we can weave social justice not only on the water but on land, because we're going to need a lot of land-based infrastructure if we're going to pull this off.
It's great, and you realize, in a project like this, which is just a small microcosm of what needs to happen, you know, in so many different industries, is really looking at building that infrastructure and looking at it as these micro communities, so that they have, as you're saying, the social justice angle. You're not training someone in isolation, you know, like one fisherman by himself, but you have 25 together. And one thing I've always found about farmers in general is we're here to share knowledge. You know, I'm on the board of NOFA New York, and, you know, you see organic farmers are sharing their knowledge. It's not, it's like, I want to compete with you. I want my farm to be better than yours, so I'm not going to tell you how I'm, you know, keeping the bugs from eating my plants organically, you know? People
exactly.
are into sharing the knowledge, and that's what
yep.
we have to do. We have to work together to share our knowledge and to, you know, build communities, because that's the other thing that is coming out so much with this, you know, in our society with all this technology, social interactions from people to people on a personal level is so reduced that people are isolated and don't feel like they're part of communities. And I think
exactly.
that's adding to the anxiety and depression, you know, in our communities. And the
other thing that's really, I mean, you know, we need to give, and I'd say the climate movement environmentalists have an obligation that every time they stop something, a coal plant, a pipeline, they have an obligation to provide economic opportunity to the workers that have been affected, right? It's not the workers' fault
right.
that they've been powering the country for 150 years as a coal worker or a steel worker or as a long-term family farm that's been feeding the country. So how do we transition and do a just transition for all these industries? And it's not just any economic activity. It's not like, I remember being in Kentucky talking to some folks, and this funder came in and was like, oh, why don't we set up call centers for all the coal families? Well, who wants that kind of job? That, you know, think of all the songs that have been written about coal workers, steel workers, fishermen, and farmers. Because these are like iconic cultural jobs with meaning, jobs that sort of fill your soul. And so the climate movement, the environmental movement, we all need to work together to create an economy that people are proud of, that they'll write songs about, right? How do we create jobs with meaning and dignity? And I think that's just really important. A lot of times it really gets lost in the discussion that this isn't just about any work. It's about work that really, you know, you're just filled with pride to wake up every morning, because that's what I had as a fisherman.
What you're saying is so right on, because with so much, you know, of our society moving towards robotics, and, you know, so many people are going to be displaced from their work, we need to have these, you know, beautiful jobs that give you dignity, that feel good, not just another tech job. I mean, someone who's out there working with their hands is not going to come in and sit behind a computer for 8 hours. It's not, or run
exactly.
a, you know, push a button for a robot. I mean, that's not going to happen. So you're so right on. But we're going to have to leave it, because we're just about out of time. Before we run out of time, I'd like you to share your contact information, or, you know, ways that people can get in touch with you or your company, Green Wave.
Yep.
To see, you know, what's going on, how they might be able to get involved.
Absolutely. So the website is greenwave.org. And we got resources there, ways to get involved. And I'd really encourage people to sort of contact their legislators and others to support a blue jobs element in the Green New Deal. I think there's an incredible opportunity. If you go, Data Progress or our website has a document called Seafood Blue Jobs in the Green New Deal, which has a bunch of proposals. And I think there's a real opportunity to get the oceans into the planning of of what a Green New Deal might look like. So thanks so much. Total honor to be here. And, keep up your amazing work.
And your amazing work, too, Brent. I'm such an admirer. And everyone out there who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Brent Smith, Executive Director of Green Wave, and me, Bhavani, at iegreen.com. See you next week. Have a great rest of the week.